Welcome to Practicing Connection, a podcast exploring the personal stories and collective practices that empower us to work together to improve our resilience and readiness in a rapidly changing world. Here to start the conversation are Jessica Beckendorf and Bob Birch.
Hey, thanks for joining us for the podcast. I'm Bob Birch. We're so excited to have you along as we continue our conversation with Dr. Bjorn Peterson. Bjorn helps social change agents find and sustain clarity, courage, and creativity in his role as a consultant, speaker, and facilitator with Looking Bear Leadership. He holds a PhD in community resources and development and has studied communication and group identity, as well as transformational leadership. We had a great conversation with Bjorn, and we're going to pick it up in this episode as Jessica shares a little bit of her experience with difficulty in speaking up in difficult workplace situations.
I was coming from a place of seeing a lot of silence and a lot of people and that silence reinforcing status quo. And I'm not blaming the people who are silent, because part of my experiences come from workplace bullying. I was in a couple of different workplace bullying scenarios earlier in my career, pretty awful ones. And I was the one who was always like raising the alarm, you know, sometimes a little quietly, but always like, have always felt like, if I don't say anything at all, I mean, at great risk, I was always saying something at really great risk. And then when I went into community development practice, I saw a lot of community meetings where people who are very powerful just being reinforced while others were being oppressed. And when people said something about it, they were either ignored, which, you know, contributes to people not saying anything, right? But, you know, I guess people like me are gluttons for punishment and just will keep saying something. And I just really appreciate that list of questions that you had earlier, Bjorn, where you're like, okay, thinking about this space, if I say something, you know, what's it serving? How, you know, being really thoughtful about that, I think is helpful, because, you know, emotionally it's hard to constantly be the person who's trying to raise the alarm about something and everyone's ignoring you, or they are seeing you as, you know, insignificant somehow, or you're alone because no one else is speaking up either, right? So maybe I just have a big mouth, but that's where my comments were coming from. You know, in a team setting, when I've witnessed and not been part of, like, I engaged in workplace bullying, but like I was the target. Other people would come to me individually and say, I see what's happening. And I'm like, oh my gosh, if we all got together, this is a small enough team that we could stop this, but they wouldn't do anything. And so things like that, you know, I think that's where my comments were coming from, that like the other people in the room can have some. But yeah, it is at great risk potentially, and it's maybe not even fair to ask them to.
No, it's, I think that last point is really important. It's really not fair, and it's not fair for so many reasons, but especially in my mind, just because we hope that collectives and communities would more often mobilize for the part of them that's hurting, that's suffering. And so often it doesn't seem like they do, right? And the loneliness of that is quite a thing. And I think what's fascinating, there's a lot of ways you could go with that reflection, but one of the things that's fascinating to me to ask and think about in terms of what I know about you, Jessica, is that the experience that you're drawing on to have that insight is also a source of power and empowerment in you as you potentially act for others, with others. And I think with my, you know, I can speak for myself, my own sort of lifelong journeys with things like depression, I think I was in a lot of spaces where the depression was seen as a failure. It was seen as like a just an indicator of unhealth, right? Which, especially in American culture, often correlates with a failure, a moral failure on my own part. If I'm unhealthy, I've morally failed myself, my body, and so on. But it took me a lot of years and a lot of self-awareness and reflection and some helpful reframing by other communities and other traditions than some of the ones that I was immediately exposed to in life, to recognize that actually my deep familiarity with sadness and suffering and unwellness is part of my superpower, if you will. It's part of what has me tuned into the things I'm tuned into. And in some ways, like your earlier statement about like, do I care about relationships and personal connection because I'm bad at them or because I'm good at them? And the answer is yes. For each of us, it's like, yeah, totally. We've had bad relationships that have taught us something about what good relationships ought to be. And we've had good relationships that make us think critically and reflectively on the bad relationships we've had. And gosh, why didn't that work? And so on. But to take it out to like this broader scale for a second, to think about it in terms of scalability and how and why this conversation relates to so many others is, you know, there's a way in which we can think about the whole of humanity, the whole of Earth, frankly, and all the sentient beings and living creatures and so on that we're a part of as a single living organism, right? And this isn't my idea. Like loads of people have said this and understood it. If we are analogous to a single living body, for instance, and you are a white blood cell whose job it is within the system to not do everything and to not respond to everything, but to respond to what you are formed in that body to do. Well, how wonderful and lovely it is that we have you. And how wonderful and lovely and important it is that others discover what it is within them that's happening through the whole. And that means too that in a community space, whether it's a public space or a retreat or an organization or a group, asking yourself what's going on in the whole is useful, but it's not necessarily important to sort of say, what if I acted like so-and-so across the way, or wouldn't what if they acted more like me? Although sometimes there's like multiple white blood cells, right? So it's not like you're necessarily alone. But the point is just to sort of go, if we think of this space that we're a part of as an ecosystem, as an ecology, as a body with different things interacting, if I sit down into what I think my role is, and I trust that you also have one, and that at your most highest capacity, your healthiest functioning, you are just as important to the system working as a whole as I am, there's for me at least both energy and hope and the things I need to keep going and to keep trying, to keep working on these incredibly complex and difficult situations that we've got unmentionable numbers of. I take a lot of hope in that. And there's a part of me too that goes, well, that's why practicing connections as an idea, as an initiative, is so valuable, not because maybe someday it'll be number one on Stitcher, but because at least for those other white blood cells or whatever, boy are they helped to know that they're not alone in setting this alarm off, right? To being this thing that sees and responds in a certain way in the world and therefore helps the world as a whole. And I then also can kind of let go of the people I think aren't enough like me. I can send them on their way and be like, you go be not me, because we need some not me's. We need mostly not me's.
I love that, what you said, Bjorn. I love the analogy. And I would love to for us to kind of continue to riff on it, but I'm gonna use it as a jumping off point to talk about something that we talked a little bit about outside of the podcast, the three of us have, and talking about coming at, as I think as you put it, coming at things at a slant, because I think that's what we maybe did a little bit there, right? Is your analogy about the world as an organism and us as part of it allowed us to kind of like shape our thinking in a way that maybe would not have been possible if we did it another way. You know, and so I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that, about your thoughts on using, you know, creativity and art and literature and music and things like that to sort of get into these conversations, the maybe some of the difficult ones that Jessica brought up earlier.
Yeah. Well, there's some well-known ideas in poetry, and I want to say it's Emily Dickinson, and somebody out there is going, that's not Emily Dickinson. It's, and I can't think of that person's name. So my apologies to
everyone make sure involved. They call you out on Twitter.
I'm sure.
Embarrassing.
There you go. But it's this idea, right, that poetry, especially as an art form, comes at things on slant, and it has this way of sneaking up on you. And it's why a good song can like sneak up on you, and you're listening to it, you're like, oh yeah, this is pretty good, and then they turn a corner and a line hits you and you're just like, whoa, what, how did I not feel that coming? And but Parker Palmer, another thinker in social change activism space, that I think he talks about the wild animal of the soul that lives inside each of us, and this idea that this inner teacher, this person, this whatever you want to call it, this thing that's within us that speaks with clarity to us, that teaches us things, that is a space of soul or of wisdom, of enlivening. It's quite shy, not unlike a wild animal is shy. And if you startle a wild animal, it will run, and you may not see it again. But if you are gentle and careful and thoughtful, you may be able to stay in the presence of a wild animal, or thinking in terms of a skittish dog. If you've ever been around a skittish dog that's kind of growling and barking or seems a little bit of aggressive, but if you turn your shoulders so that they're not facing, and you turn your eyes slightly at a slant, so your body is at a slant to the dog, and you hold out your hand, and you show that you're trustworthy and that you're not a threat, then all of a sudden you may be able to befriend that dog, or that dog may find peace with you at the very least, right, and just kind of calm down and lay over there, and they may not become your best friend, but a certain stability and trustworthiness to the kind of relationship you're going to have is established. So it's this idea, right, that there are these things in life that we come at us on slant, and because of that, it opens up a capacity and a spaciousness within our minds and bodies to encounter something we might not otherwise have been able to encounter. And a lot of my interest in this comes through the idea of metaphors and metaphor work that does so much framing for the type of relationship or the type of encounter that we're going to have. And so thinking about earlier when I was talking about the meeting space, for instance, and what kind of space people believe they're coming into, a lot of our civic spaces that are really transformative are based on things like arts practice, right? Or they're based on play, where people are allowed to, you know, when you play, you can miss a shot. You know, right? The sort of famous American saying is like, if you missed 7 out of 10 times in baseball hitting, like you can still be a Hall of Fame player if that's your career average, right? But in a civic space, We're often like, if 7 out of 10 things I say at a public meeting seem like a miss, I'm done. No one's going to listen to me. I'm not going to participate, and so on. So the lack of play or the lack of creative expression that comes into these kind of spaces often contributes to the perfectionism and to the lack of spaciousness that we give one another. So how we create space, how we practice connection, using things that don't send us into defensive positions, that don't send us running because they scare us, or that keep us present long enough to listen to something we didn't think we were going to hear or be able to hear, are really valuable in this kind of work that we're talking about.
You know, Bjorn, that I think can also translate to if you serve clients one-on-one and you're supposed to be the quote-unquote expert in the room, and 7 out of 10 times it's a miss. It could be very difficult for your client to feel they can trust you. And at the same time, I think about, you know, wise words of wisdom from Adrienne Marie Brown, in when she says in her book Emergent Strategy, one of the strategies is to trust the people. And so I think as a facilitator or as a service provider of any kind, you not only have to trust the people that are coming into the room and that they bring all kinds of knowledge about their own lives and about their themselves and about their feelings and about their feelings about whatever topic it is or whatever it is you guys are gathering around, but also you need to trust yourself to serve in a way that walks that line, that is fully open while also making sure to build that trust along the way. I mean, I think you can play. I think you still can play. It's just like you said, Bjorn, 7 out of 10 times in like a public forum, and if it's a miss, that's difficult, right? And adults coming together, I mean, I think I've told you this before. It's one of the reasons why I love being a practitioner of applied improvisation, because when I see adults play, it is incredible. It is transformational. It is beautiful. And yet, how do we bring more of that play and that interplay and exploration? I've said that before, exploration with each other, both in one-on-one settings and in these group settings where people are trying to look to you to maybe be an expert of some sort. That was a lot. Sorry.
No, it's good stuff. And there's so many things it brings up. So some of the things that get in our way of play are some of the things that we can try to address ahead of time to a certain extent. And sometimes, look, if truthfully, I'm the person for whom certain kinds of play are really going to set me off. And that has to do with my own personal trauma, my own personal background, things I experienced earlier in life that for a long time, I thought I was just kind of like a grump and didn't want to do certain things, right? I was like, Bjorn, get over yourself and do this. It wasn't actually until some reflection on white supremacy culture and some of the religious spaces that I was a part of where I started to realize, oh no, this is my body and mind going alert, alert, alert. Like, there's unhealthy decisions ahead in this play, right? But you can't.
Trusting play is hard.
It is.
Especially with, you know, past experiences, for sure.
Totally. And my point is certainly not that, like, you know, you're going to be able to find play that avoids all other people's trauma. You're not, right? Like, you just can't know what particular painful thing has happened in the past of every person who comes into the room, but some diversity, some variety helps quite a bit in terms of that. But what I think is so amazing about, say, improv or something else that gets us out of our metaphorical, the way we are organized metaphorically, and I mean this in terms of sometimes like face to face, and this goes back to this slant idea, it goes back to the us versus them idea, is that we sort of are set up to have certain proximity and relate and physical experiences when we encounter someone physically in a certain way. So if I have a hug, there's certain things that physiologically and emotionally and mentally should go on in theory if I'm healthy. But if I sit down face to face with all my people next to me and you sit down across from me, then like I have a similar sort of, there's a prophecy spoken into the space that's usually self-fulfilling. Play like improv can disrupt that. The other thing that I really like to do, about to do it with a group here in a couple of weeks again, is take people on walks in the woods, silent walks, to think about an issue. To so we pose a question, we think, we put a lot of time and thought into the questions that we ask, but we might explore something like workplace dynamics, for instance, since that came up. And we invite people to find new metaphors in the environment to give expression to older experiences or current experiences in order to hopefully open up new ways of thinking about it, because we can become quite ingrained in our structures and our patterns of thinking. And, you know, this area of work, you know, brought me into the study of metaphor analysis and so on, because I was curious about, well, how do the stories that we tell reveal some of what's going on within us from an identity standpoint as community workers? And so I did some work in India and some other places, and, you know, made some similar observations in Scotland and South Africa, and of course, here in the States. And one of the things I noticed is that we tend to play out organizational metaphors or structural metaphors again and again, where we kind of have characters, and our stories might vary, but there are characters in the world, there are forces in the world, and we sort of make sense of the world and therefore choose our corrective action or our intervention or whatever in the world based on those characters that we create, those stories that we tell and retell. But metaphors are always a partial explanation of any phenomenon or any story. So for instance, if I say that we were arguing, you would draw on metaphors that you have for arguing in order to make sense of my story, right? And for many of us, you might have drawn on a metaphor or conceptual metaphor, for instance, that George Lakoff pointed out, which is that argument is war. Meaning that it's the kind of argument where I shot down your ideas and there was going to be one winner, and it was a battle of attrition, or it was whatever these, but this tells you the character of the interaction we had. And those types of conceptual metaphors that live deeply within our lived experiences and our interpretations of previous experiences help set the expectations and ground rules and horizons of possibility for future interactions. Whereas if I had told you that we had an argument, but you understood that argument was dance, then you might have thought, well, so you kind of went around and around, and you led sometimes and they led sometimes. Now I'm evoking a completely different potential experience of the same reported thing, argument. So this is partly what metaphor work can help us do in communities or collectives, is it can help us access metaphors that open up possibilities and conditions and interactions and relationships that we have tended to look past, because we just think, if I tell you that our problem as a team is that all we can ever do is argue, and I'm thinking in terms of war, because that's how it's played out, what way out of those habits of interaction might we find if the next time we started feeling like we were arguing, one of us could name, to sort of say, could we have this discussion as though we were dancing? And it's so weird and I don't know about it and it sounds dumb and whatever, but could we just try it and just see where it goes? And just see if just a tiny little bit more spaciousness might be found. And in the best examples that I've seen, you know, people find whole new organizing metaphors for problems that they have just not been able to get past, because they used to think their funding model was a brick wall, and now they think it's a dry riverbed. And for some reason, that shift in metaphor allows new possibilities and new wonderings to come along, that to create possibility and capacity where it wasn't, you know, just hours or days before.
So I have a question about this, because I've worked with a lot of different groups, and I've even implemented some of the work that you've done. And in fact, I was very much attracted to this idea of coming at things at a slant, and even using the art, literature, music. But I have to say that when I work with groups, that's the part that I think they have the toughest time with. And frankly, it's the part that I understand, and yet, you know, I would like to learn a lot more, and I'd like to learn to do this better. So how practically can you go from thinking of, you know, for instance, your funding model, you know, to really shifting that metaphor? Because I don't know, has that been your experience too, that groups have a kind of hard time with this idea of completely changing? Like, it's like changing a complete mental model, really.
It is. It's a big ask. And so there are two things that I try to keep in mind. And one is that we don't have to land on the perfect metaphor right away. And in fact, part of what we're trying to do is sort of suggest that the metaphor might be more dynamic than we've tended to have it be, right? So just giving it permission to not need to be singular and perfect is a big, important permission thing. And then second of all, part of why I do this, where I try to pose these questions and then walk through the woods, is because if we want people to draw on lots of different metaphors, but then we ask them in a conference room around a plastic table and the same IKEA furniture or whatever that's in every single room, then they're going to all just turn into, like, maybe we should be a Swedish furniture company. And that is obviously not the goal.
What I see over and over is, we just need to come together, write down the tasks, assign the tasks, and break. Like, that's all I ever see.
yeah, totally. And I think part of it too is that for many of us, for one, we don't always understand the way our own minds work. And so all this can sound a little bit weird and like, and so actually, from like a pedagogical standpoint, from a learning philosophy standpoint, there's value in sort of explaining to a certain extent what we're trying to do. I'm going to say five things and you're going to be like, I do all five of those things. And then we'll have to have a more conversation. But so, you know, explaining the pedagogical value, right, is can be valuable. Also, to a certain extent, I don't know what you do, but for instance, I like to bring some different options to get them started at least. And sometimes what I'll have groups do as a way of introduction, and also sort of introducing music into, for instance, the experience, is sort of say, so what you're talking about in my context is the cycle of praxis idea, where people are trying to unpack a lived experience to identify felt needs and address those felt needs. And then they get to a point in the process where it's suggested that they draw on ways of knowing beyond the sort of academic. And if I put it that way, most of us would be like, I don't know what that means. What should I do? So fair enough. But what I will sometimes do, or invite people to do, is think about, to introduce themselves to the experience using a song or a poem or an object, and to sort of say, bring an object that represents for you some way that you're experiencing this issue that we gathered to talk about. Right. And so that's where all of a sudden participants might bring in stuff that's totally off the wall. And I've done this in a lot of different ways, but everything from songs, where it's like, play us a song. And here's what we're going to do. Our 10 today is going to be about listening to good music. Who doesn't love that? You're going to feel like it's a waste. Trust me, it may be. get used to some waste. And we can come back to that in a second. But But the point is where we would be like, all right, Bjorn, tell us about this, I don't know, this Lizzo song that you want us to listen to. It's about damn time. All right. So I'm going to say, so the song I brought today, my name is Bjorn. The song I brought today is It's About Damn Time by Lizzo. And here's why it makes me think of the situation we're in. And so let's listen to it. So we listen to it. Everyone hears it. They get to kind of reflect on what I was saying. And I might, and then as a facilitator, I'd say, Bjorn, any other thoughts on that before we move on? Thanks for sharing. And maybe he goes, you know, I forgot to say that it's because of this and this and this. All right, cool. Thank you. Moving on. Jessica, tell us about your song. And it just gets people, for one, it allows a piece of art to do the self-expressing that for those of us who spend a lot of time on self-awareness become quite practiced at. But for a lot of people, it's like, I don't know. What do you mean self-awareness? What do you mean talked about myself? What do you mean any of this? So giving people things outside of their own tongue, out of their own mouth, some way to introduce themselves allows them to start thinking in terms of the cultures and the circles that they're a part of. And what it also does is it fills the room with metaphor. It fills the room with imagery and objects and poetry that later Bob can be like, you know, I didn't think about this at all, and I had never heard of Lizzo, but actually there's that line in it, and what Bjorn said it meant to him, that's exactly what I've been thinking and been feeling. And now it starts a communication between me and Bob and the groom that wasn't there at the beginning because we didn't know how to access that language. And I think especially in some of the communities that we're a part of, you know, y'all are in Wisconsin, North Dakota, I'm here in Minnesota. People who come from my Northern European background, sometimes, you know, we're not always effusive, and we don't always give you lots of data to work with when we're listening. So sometimes we're like, yeah, no, that's not right. Okay.
And but that's we're it. Really nice most of the time.
We're really quietly nice. no, but so how do you draw people out, and how do you make sure too that the same voices aren't dominating? That's another useful way where you can kind of go through or have some people bring in an object that represents the situation that they're in, or an object that represents the courage that they feel, or the reason that they're deciding to act, right? Any of that can be valuable and provides material for the room that's not just about what you brought to, which can be useful, but how do you get more people involved in the curation of that cultural material than just, for instance, again, me as the white heterosexual, overeducated man? One of the things that I take some personal and professional solace in, right, is hearing about Stephen Hawking, you know, wrote A Brief History of Time as this crazy physicist, you know, and he spent a good chunk of his life, and people can blow me up on Twitter correcting you later too on this, but he spent a good chunk of his life and work explaining the universe in one way and being kind of all in on it. And then he changed and basically spent like the second half of his life refuting his own groundbreaking theories. And there's a part of me that's like, yeah, I'm not Stephen Hawking, but I'm comfortable with the idea that I might revise all of this in a few years. And knowing that that could be true kind of liberates me a little bit in the moment to just sort of go, you know, I'm not here to be a guru. I don't need that kind of pressure. I'm not that perfect, and I don't want that kind of attention. And if somebody comes along and can do this differently or better, that's great. And I'm reading you this poem because I am, and somebody else didn't. I don't know what to tell you. Like, it's weird. There's this wonderful meeting that happens. And if you read my journals, you'd find they are full of me, you know, coming home at the end of a day where I felt like I was so vulnerable with a group, and they met me there. And I am always like, holy man, it happened again. Like, I can't believe that humans respond to vulnerability with generosity and hospitality. because so often it feels like they don't. But in actual human-to-human relationship, not when I'm on social media and I can throw bombs from behind my computer, but when I'm actually with other humans, boy, we there's something good in us that does so often respond, and not every time. And I have those traumatic experiences as well, but it is beautiful, and I do take hope in all the times it does happen.
Oh, Bjorn, I want to thank you so much for being on this episode of Practicing Connection. It's been a wonderful conversation, and I think I speak for Jessica too. We're so thankful to have this opportunity to learn from you and learn with you, and hopefully we can talk again soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a real treasure.
I had so much more I wanted to talk about. We're going to have to continue this conversation.
Can't wait.
I want to thank you, our listeners, as well for joining us for this conversation. And we'd also like to thank our announcer, Kaylin Goble, Hannah Hyde, and Terry Meisenbach for their help with marketing, and Nathan Grimm, of course, who composed and performed all the music you hear on the podcast. Thanks, Nathan. And finally, thanks for joining us, and I hope that you'll join us again real soon. In the meantime, keep practicing.
The Practicing Connection podcast is a production of OneOp and is supported by the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Office of Military Family Readiness Policy, U.S. Department of Defense, under award number 2019-48770-30366.